Hi, everybody. Welcome to episode number 79 of the Alexis L podcast. And today we have a guest, Tig Hickey. Is that right? Am I saying
beautiful.
That right?
Yeah, it's thank beautifully you. Pronounced. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. And so we know, so just like jump right in here. You partly come to our attention because of your activism for Palestine. But I'm also interested in, I guess, how you get started, you know, your journey as a comedian. Journey. I wish there was another word for that, really, but there isn't. Journey, unfortunately, is the word. Whether how you become a comedian in Ireland, really. What's the scene like there? And then also, what does Graham Linehan think?
He doesn't like me at all. Yeah, he doesn't like me at all. Yeah.
You see, he loved me. Yeah. Did he love you first? He loved me first, and now he hates me, I think.
He probably just didn't know me first, so I feel jealous of you there that I'd never had that kind of arc. he just came in hot with the hatred for me,
No, I have that. I have that. It probably happened to Talal, though. You're probably, but you know, as young these young men young I take ones. Under my wing, and it starts out, it all goes well, and then at some point. It goes horribly wrong, really.
I can't wait to start doing that. That's my dream.
What's going to be my big controversy then?
I don't know. We've seemed to have avoided it so far. But it's an age, you know, when you, there's a theory, there's a kind of Jungian theory that seasons of a man's life, that when a man reaches his kind of 60s, he becomes the teacher. You know, he stops striving to do stuff, to accumulate, and instead becomes the kind of sage of the village, you know, and takes young men under his wing and instructs them. And I've tried to do that several times, and it's ended so badly. I can't tell you how. Oh man, it's just. I mean, luckily, we've kept out the courts and kind of exclusion orders and so on so far, but it's not gone. One woman, but mostly men. It's not gone well.
Well, like, but if you could put your finger on why it doesn't go well, like what is it, do you think?
Excessive neediness on my part, really, and I think probably choosing the wrong people, really, one of them's a fucking host on GB News, you know.
The fuck?
Oh wow!
I know. Yeah, I'm solely doing that, I think, as an act of kind of rebellion against me, really. He's gone to the trouble of becoming a host on a right wing TV channel. Just
my head is trying to figure out who that is now.
Josh Howie. He's called.
He hates me as well, actually.
Oh, does he?
Big time, big style.
Yeah.
Well, there's no risk of.
But we share that we've got a lot in common so far.
No risk that I'm going to go down that path, Alexis.
Always going to be. Well, because
I was listening to this podcast by this guy Andrew Tate the other day, and he had something really cool to say. about this
he's
topic.
A good guy.
I think we should just hear him out. Let's just hear him out.
Because he's just said, you know, can you put it so frankly, the problem with immigrants, and it's not racist, is...
Yeah. It's what we're all thinking.
Yeah.
Well, look, I've been self-sabotaging myself since before I started working with you, Alex.
It won't
be your fault.
I've got better at it.
Anyway, we have a guest today.
Yes, anyway, sorry, yeah.
No, I'm loving about... this, though. I'm loving this, because I wish we'd recorded a bit about Eric Clapton, but at least we got the Graham Linehan stuff. Graham Linehan just fascinates me, though. Like, I talk about him for an hour, like, oh.
Yeah, it's surprising. You'll get loads of because he also has these insanely devoted fans, doesn't he?
Yeah, yes. And some of them do listen to this show.
I mean, and it's well, I mean, it's
what's your theory? Like, what happened?
I don't really. I mean, my arc with him is that I was went after Rennick, David Rennick and Andrew Marshall, we'd done three series of stuff for BBC, and Rennick was writing One Foot in the Grave, and so he wasn't available, and then Andrew was also doing a series called 2.4 Children, so I was looking for new writers, and a friend of mine suggested Graham and Arthur, and so I took them on as writers for my the All New Alexei Sayle Show. We did two series of that.
Yes.
And they, I mean, Graham was, I mean, he was young then. The two of them were fine, really, then. I mean, Graham, because they
Nobody
were young.
Nobody wants
and
that review.
Yeah.
He was fine.
He was all right. No, he was fine. I mean, but he became, I mean, he never, I mean, I sort of jokingly, I mean, they then went on to do, they wrote a sitcom for me, Paris, which was a disaster.
Yes.
Yeah, an absolute disaster. Mm. And then, I sort of say, you know, and then they went on to do Father Ted. And I was, you know, all the people, you know, where's my fucking cameo as Father O'Shagalag? I don't know, Father.
Oh, well, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I never got a cameo. Why didn't I get a cameo as a fucking priest or rabbi? You had a funny rabbi.
You know, they crawled the streets of Ireland to find anybody doing comedy to give a cameo to that show. So, it's mental that you weren't in it.
I know. Maybe that was where Graham's, you know, it's Oedipus as well, isn't it? You know, it's killing your father.
He wanted that show, obviously, to be extremely Irish. There was very little, if any, England or British characters in
that.
Yeah,
that's true. That's true, I suppose.
He did write good jokes for you, to be fair.
Oh, he did. He was great, you know. And they did admire me at first, really. But it, you know, I'm a great sort of initial friend. I remember telling this to I was being interviewed by a woman from the Scotsman once, and I was saying, I said, I'm a great friend. We would become great friends at first, I said, you know. But then, you know, when the weeping midnight phone calls start, you will, you know, that it will. And she was like, that phrase, their jaw dropped.
Yes.
You know, so she stared at me, you know, I was like, it's just a joke, you know. But, and she, Linda used to give me a talk, like, you're doing these interviews. You're trying to impress these journalists. You're not trying to unsettle them and make them uncomfortable. But I never really learned that lesson. And back to Graham. And then Graham, I think his head got turned a bit because he was mixing with, you know, I mean, a quite a powerful crowd, really, all those people from Talk Back and Edgar Wright and another of my proteges, and who's never given me a fucking cameo. And I think he just got very... I think it comes from arrogance, really. His upfall and then his downfall, really, is about thinking that you know the answer to everything.
Yes. I always think this trans thing is like, it's something like somebody who's sharted. Like, it's almost like he's gone away from the family with the family for the weekend and he's sharted, right? And the wife is like, you need to clean yourself up. And he's like, no, hold on a second. This mightn't be all my fault, like, you know. And the kids are like, Dad, look, this has gone on long enough. And now he's at the window, like, and the police are like, Graham, you need to fucking come down. This is over, like, you know. And he's like, you don't know what I ate last night, like, and it could be you, like, it could be your... Like, it just seems like there was so many opportunities to de-escalate this, like, and instead he's just burned his fucking life down, like, you know, it's mental. I just began that and I was like, do they know what a shart is? A shart an Irish thing?
I think it's
I'm very familiar.
We're big sharters over here, guys. Big sharters.
We've been going for how long? Been going for 9 minutes and haven't even started on your career. So tell us how you got started, first of all, I suppose. What's the scene like over there?
Yeah, so I started off probably in music, really. I'm like, I was a singer in a band. The band is kind of still vaguely going, electronic music, 80s kind of stuff, all that kind of jazz. I did acting. I did like regular acting, but I was just kind of like trying to get into comedy, but I didn't have the balls to do it until I was probably in my maybe early late 20s, maybe. And then very quickly, I mean, I grew up watching surreal comedy, like, you know, like, you're not blowing smoke, but like, I mean, yourself and, you know, the young ones and Bottom and all that kind of stuff. That's a staple stuff for me when I was a kid. I was always attracted to that kind of mad stuff as opposed, like, you know, regular situation comedy kind of stuff. For my own sketch group, and we had good bit of success here in Ireland. We had our own sitcom and whatnot. And the group was called Cahoots, with three C's for I can't remember why exactly, but all our stuff is on YouTube, and it's some good kind of offbeat. I think it's good. It's actually, yeah, I'm really happy with it. Like, you know, I'm proud of it and stuff, but I was very political very early on, and I never found a way to kind of marry the politics and the comedy. So Ireland is like weirdly quite, you know, conservative. We've never had like a left-leaning government here. You'd have to kind of leave your leftism at the door, like particularly the leftism that would be associated with Irish republicanism and stuff. Yeah. That would be seen as kind of a bit dirty. So I always had to kind of park my politics really if I was to get work with the national broadcaster. And then somewhere along that, like before COVID kind of area, I think I just decided to just smash the whole thing to the ground really and see what happens, because I was just sick of not being fully kind of me in the comedy, I think. So then I started doing more political comedy, and to my great, great surprise, there was like a massive appetite for it online. I couldn't believe it. Like, I did the sketch about the British Empire just in my house at the start of COVID, just like wearing wigs and playing different characters, like taking on and off my jumper. And it had like millions of hits on Twitter and stuff. And then I suddenly realized, oh, there's all these people around the world that are interested in anti-imperialist comedy. And that was kind of like a bit of the comedy journey. I'd done lots of stand-up as well, but I wouldn't be a stand-up guy, I don't think, really. I don't get that rush. Like, and this is one of the questions I wanted to ask from you. Like, is the live thing the complete bedrock for you, Alexi? Like, is that, do you need to do that, or did you need to do that?
I think that it was obviously the it was the basis of what I did, that I started, you know, you start out doing, you don't get directly onto the TV or whatever. I started out doing live stuff, and then I was the MC of the Comedy Store.
Yes.
The original MC, and that's what started the comedy revolution in Britain. And I was sort of central to that. And so, we all met each other, the young ones and the comic strip crew all met each other working live. And then, I wish I loved the life more, really. I mean, it was definitely the bedrock of what I was doing, working live. And it is really nice to be with an audience, really. Stuart Lee is obviously kind of provides a template, that a kind of template in that he works every night. You know, he does.
Yeah.
He does more gigs than there are days in the year kind of thing. And so,
yes.
And you know, you can see it in his work that there's a polish, really, there's a confidence with an audience that, you know, that is sublime to watch, really. And I don't have that. I'm always sort of, when I do the occasional live gig, I'm always on the edge because I've not done it enough, really.
Yeah.
You were just saying last week how much you hated touring.
I grew to hate touring. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, the traveling and, it certainly was. And I think it's, you know, when I do my award-winning radio show, I always work the material live. Just slip that in. You're listening. You're listening, all my failed sons.
Take that, Graham.
My dude's got fucking hundreds of bloody awards. But, I always work the material live first, and it is nice. It's nice now. I was looking at reading a comment somewhere and just saying they'd come to one of those tryouts and just saying how my face lit up when I was in front of an audience, really, you know. And it is a wonderful thing to do. I just wish I loved it more, really.
Good opportunity to say that we've got three live Alexi Sell podcasts coming up, listeners.
the Museum of Comedy.
Google the Museum of Comedy. Go to their website. See what's on. You'll find the Alexis Tell podcast live. We've got tickets left to sell. Grab them before they're gone. Thank you. thank you very much. Tig, it sounds like you had a lot of practice then doing solo video sketches before the genocide on the Palestinian people, because the quality of your sketches on that topic, and I think I've seen some other topics that you've covered as well, but really high quality sketches, and like you're playing all the characters and the editing's really clean and everything. Do you prefer that to playing with your sketch group and being with other people, or was it just out of necessity because of the politics issue?
Yeah, like the sketch group just naturally came to an end around COVID time. And as I say, like, I mean, this is just on me. There's nobody was specifically telling me not to do it, but it was very hard to get the politics into the type of comedy that we were doing. And certainly if you were to do overtly left-leaning comedy, you have no opportunity to get work with the national broadcaster in Ireland. Like, no way whatsoever. They're unbelievably safe. They don't want any... We don't really have much even surreal comedy on TV here, much. It's still a very conservative kind of society and whatnot. So the sketches that of me playing all the characters actually kind of came out of a bit of COVID as well, that I was just in a house and it was my mate was with me, and, you know, it was kind of a necessity more than anything else. But interestingly, at the start of the genocide, I had already made sketches about Palestine because that was the kind of shtick that I was doing anyway. So like the first couple of sketches that I put out were just resharing stuff that I had already done, but it seemed like the world just woke up. Yeah, like I think like the first two ones I put out were just reshares. And also I've got Palestinian friends in Cork, so I wasn't even sure about doing comedy, to be honest with you. I was like, well, what on earth would comedy have to do in this space right now? But it was my Palestinian friends here were just like, no, definitely get in here, like, because this is going to be a kind of a media battle as well. It's going to be a narrative battle, and we kind of need satire. Like, so look, I'm not an idiot. I know the strength that satire can have, but it was an unusual situation, as I'm sure you get, to try and say something vaguely humorous or satirical in the middle of ongoing mass murder, as opposed to reflecting on something that had happened. You know, like, for instance, if you did a sketch about the famine right now in Ireland, it would be pretty saucy stuff. Like, you know, you'd be a bit like, whoa, I'm not sure. Like, it could be too soon. Let alone
potato famine.
Yeah, exactly.
That famine.
Like, you know what I mean? As in, like, it's genocide is, you know, it's not very fucking, you got to be careful with it, especially when it's ongoing. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it was, again, Palestinians, because as you know, they've just got outrageously dark senses of humor anyway.
Yeah.
And they were like, you're not going to be mocking us. Like, get in there and mock the Hasbro and stuff. So,
how has that changed your life, really, I suppose? Two things, really. How has it changed life, and also go into the reasons why you think genocide's a bad idea?
I've never been a fan. I've never been a fan of it.
Yeah, we have to show kind of broadcasterly, you know, unbiased.
Absolutely.
So we have pro genocide, argue why genocide, good idea, why. We have to have somebody on. Go on, anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, like, I mean, it's changed my life insofar as I've accidentally.
What a question. You do put it, if you put it like that, it's outrageous that anyone out there is still fighting for the Israeli cause, you know?
Yeah, it's true, it's true. Yeah. It's actually a perfectly satirical question, because it's absolutely true. Like I was saying to a mate of mine the other day, I would be shitting myself if I were a Zionist and I had to do something like this, or I had to do media anywhere. Because you're in a position where you have to defend the mass murder of mostly women and children. Like, you're going to have to find a reason to legitimize it. It seems like an impossible position to me. I wouldn't like to take it on at all, like, but yeah.
They manage it. Unconvincingly. But yeah, so...
Look, it changed my life insofar as I've accidentally become a kind of an activist, you know? Because I suppose, like, I saw the activism as something that I was doing on the side whilst trying to pursue a comedy career for most of my adult life. And now it's almost gone the other way, because like, for instance, my Instagram is like just an open book. Like, anybody who wants to use it, anyone who wants to collaborate, particularly Palestinians, I just like always say yes. So I'm definitely doing more. Like, the media asks that I have these days are more to do with activism than they are to do with comedy. But like, I'm absolutely at peace with that. Like, I feel privileged to be in the position that I'm in, that, you know, I've got a big enough social media presence that I can push the message out there. But I mean, my main thing in terms of how it's changed my life is like my even vague, fleeting faith in any kind of system, any international law, any rules, any fairness is just completely gone. As I say, like, I spend a lot of my friends in Cork are Palestinian, and like, you're just watching people oscillate from rage to deep sadness, like on a minute by minute basis. You know, what do you say to them? Like, I've literally run out of, like, I'm going to see them later today, and I've completely run out of things to say. They still send me the videos of like children being burned in their tents last night. They still send me all the stuff because I suppose I'm in a small list of people that they can continue to send things to, so that they feel like they're, I don't know, honoring the people who've died. But what do I say? I say, oh, just hold tight. Like, I'm going to do another protest on the streets of Cork next weekend. You know what I mean? Like, it's obviously not working. We're trying our best, but it's not working. So I don't know what to say to these people anymore. So,
No. That is something that, I mean, it is, I think, something that all of us on the left and just any human being has this situation has shown us that we were living kind of in a fool's paradise, really, where we thought there were laws, where we thought there was humanity in our governments, in our politicians. We thought there was restraint, you know, we thought there was kindness and justice, and none of that is the case. And so to wake up every morning, to the realization that, you know, that there is no law, that there is no kindness, there is no justice, it's a horrible, you know, I mean, most people most people can't look at that, can they? And it's a difficult thing to look at in the face. And I guess one of the only ways that you can at least partially learn to live with it is to actively do your best to campaign against it, even though, you know, we are coming from a position of relative powerlessness, I think.
But I don't want to, you know, like a friend said to me recently, you know, when you look back at this, you can hold your head up high and you did your bit or whatever. Like, I'm not interested in that stuff at all. Who gives a shit about that? Like, so when I'm dying, I can go, oh, Jesus, I've shared a few videos about the genocide. Fuck off. Like, I want to try and whatever, like, bit of popularity that I have, I want to use that page or pages to try and organize people into like fucking hitting the streets. Like, you know, I just cannot believe that there's not mass. I can't believe we are not in the middle of an active revolution right now. Like, if we're witnessing this level of horror, you know, it just blows my mind.
Yeah. But it is one of the sort of consoling lies, I think, that people on the left, and you can understand it, but they tell themselves, at least we did our best. And like you say, fuck that. That's not enough. That's not fucking even, you know, tiny bit of enough, really. You know, at least we submitted a composite motion to the Labour Party annual conference that didn't get through. You know, at least we did that. Fuck off. Do more.
It's heartbreaking.
Realize that is no consolation. The system is against you. Yeah, and why aren't? I mean that. It's like being in a, I mean, it's a, I mean, it's like being in a fucking sci-fi movie, isn't it, in some ways, this as well.
Yeah. And I think you're right. People are very eager to kind of say, like, we've done this, you know, like, we've done this, like, we've marched X amount and like, we've clocked up that much kind of, like, activism miles, and now we can kind of, but no, there's no material difference. Like, if you still got mates who are saying, oh, like, you're like, one of my mates, the family next to his in Gaza were all exterminated like about a week ago. I mean, it's very hard to turn around to him then and say, like, well, like, I've actually done my bit. Like, I'm all marched out, you know, so best of luck with the rest of the genocide. You know, it's just, I suppose the whole world is insane. That's the thing. I definitely feel a bit insane. You know what I mean? I think we're all mad. People who've like stayed with it have collectively gone insane. I'm noticing that, like, you know, amongst our community here in Cork. I'm sure it's the same. I'm talking to a lot of people in Britain anyway, but it's the same over there, is it?
Yeah, we have been driven mad by the cruelty of I definitely suffer. I mean, it's a good description, really. They revel in it, and I mean the design is probably they're pleased with that as well, that they've driven us mad. But our humanity has sent us crazy, really, to witness this.
I was at my mum's birthday dinner last night, and I was just kind of staring blankly at the wall, with a really grim look on my face. And then my brother-in-law said, "Are you okay, Tal? What's wrong? Has someone upset you?" And I just I was about to start talking. I just thought, I have to. I'm either going to talk and not stop and ruin everyone's day, or I just fucking say, "Oh no, I'm all right. Don't worry. I was just thinking about something."
It's just that pesky genocide is kind of annoying me again.
Turn off every now and then. And think about the reality of the situation and the gravity of it all, and it's maddening. Yeah, you're right.
That's so true, man. I'm in that loop at the moment, where I can feel, even there's people in my life that are definitely finding me really tedious. I'm with people, and all I want to talk about is the fact that we need a global intifada. And somebody's telling me about some offer that they're after getting an Aldi, and I'm finding them boring, but I know they're finding me boring because they just want to get on with their lives. We're in this mutual bore fest, I don't know.
What is the offer? What is it? What is the offer?
Tell you exactly, right?
Yeah, I think I prefer Lidl to Aldi, but
what? Yeah. Oh, you're a madman.
I think it's true. The produce in Lidl is a bit better quality than Aldi.
Are you serious, guys? No, I'm an Aldi fundamentalist.
Really? Sell it to us.
I'll die for that franchise. Yeah, no, I love it. It's just down the road for me. I'll be honest, it's just down the road.
But they're do they still stock the Israeli flushable toilet wipes in case you sharted?
What do you mean in case? All
the times that we've sharted, yes.
Graham Linehan special,
For him and her, and that's it.
Very good, very good. Final point on him, actually. You know that he doesn't give a shit, You know what I mean? He doesn't actually care about women. All the posts I'm just defending women. He doesn't give a fuck. He's just defending his... somebody criticized a joke that he did 20 years ago. That's what it is,
Well, if he cared about women, he would have changed before his wife left him and... that's the main woman in his life. Something about her before you start ranting. No.
Exactly. Go on, sorry.
Aldi.
Aldi. Let me plug.
They said made in Israel on the packet. Maybe that was just a little.
There's a group in Ireland. If you don't know them, check them out. BDS Belfast. They're the absolute pride of the country. Every single day, they go to various shops in the north, and they stage sit-ins and they do public announcements. They let people know exactly which products in the shop, wherever they are, that are in any way connected to the Zionist regime. There's a small little group of them.
And
they're just doing it every day,
And
they're even at the point now with some people within the community are probably I'm just trying to do my shopping. Could you just leave me alone? They're kind of relentless, and they're facing that kind of sting and activism where... fatigue is coming in, and within your own ranks are probably giving you shit, but they keep going. They're just, they're a big inspiration. So I said, when we were talking about Aldi and Lidl there, I'd throw them in.
And we should promote, because boycotts work. I mean, it's one of the reasons why they try and make it illegal and stuff. If you're a speech therapist in Texas, you can't get hired unless you say you won't boycott Israel. It's really good. It really does. That is something that does. That is a non-violent protest. That really does work, and I would encourage everybody. And it has, having some effects, isn't it? KFC is closed down in Turkey. Starbucks is obviously taking a hit all over the world, McDonald's and so on, but also Israeli products, Boycott them really, really. I would urge anybody and listening to really take a look at where stuff is produced and not buy it if it's going to be this.
100%.
Yeah, but, yeah.
But you must get a, you must get an incredible amount of personal abuse, Alexi, do you, because of your stance?
No, because I think because I'm not on social media really, so they can't really. There's nowhere to find me to give me that abuse. You know, it's not. You know, I think I've talked about this before, but it's not like being deported or attacked in the street. When I did Desert Island Discs in 2020, I think it was, that the campaign against that, well, one of their fronts, a Conservative MP called Matthew Offord, you know, obviously working.
Oh, yeah.
I think for them, tried to get that show banned, really. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's actually, you know, I stand with Alexi Sale, hashtag, you know, trended for days on, you know, everybody came out and supported me, really. So I think I have probably, I mean, I'm not saying that this will last forever, but because I've been involved in, you know, kind of, you know what you're getting with me, and also that I've been doing anti-racist comedy for 40 odd years, over 40.
Yes.
That my last radio series, my last award-winning radio series that went out, was full of all, you know, I think they've just kind of given up with me, really. It's easier to ignore me than to attack me, really, which is not to say that it won't happen in the future, but I think I am the one person who sort of gets away with it, really, you know?
Yes.
And it's still possible. I mean, that may, in Starmer's fascist Britain, that may not go on forever. But for the moment, I think I'm kind of allowed, really, so I don't get, even this podcast doesn't really get much abuse, does it?
No, we don't, because no one listens to it.
So clever.
I'm allowed to make that self, do that self. Yes, it's a really clever, it's a really clever strategy. It's a strategy that the left has pursued for many years, to have no effect. And to do nothing means that it's a brilliant way to avoid repression, really. It's an incredibly brilliant strategy.
We did our bit.
To do nothing, yeah. To do nothing and to challenge nothing means that the state can't clamp down on you. It's a
fantastic. We call it a draw, strategy. Exactly. Call it a draw.
No, I don't get any messages of hate towards you or calling you anti-Semitic or anything like that. I think that's the concentration of our listenership.
Yeah,
is pure, and they're all on board. Yeah,
yeah,
it's nice.
But what about the when you did the address, the Stephen Fry spoof? I'm shocked that you didn't get like lots of abuse for that.
Again, I don't. Oh, we probably did.
Well, that had too many comments to sit and read all of them. But that had lots of views. And,
there was
so beautiful.
Yeah, no, it came out of just I mean, the best comedy in a sense, sometimes it comes, you know, I just heard what he was about to do, saw the text of it and felt, and we threw that piece together in a couple of days, really.
It is when it's of the moment and that's when it's really driven by passion.
Yeah, it works well, really, you know.
The longer you think about doing something, the less you want to do it, really.
That's very true. Yeah. You got to trust your instinct.
I haven't bumped, you know, it's a weird kind of parallel world that I live in, whereas, doing that sort of stuff and speaking at Trafalgar Square. But also there is a chance that I would be at a party where Stephen Fry would be.
Of course.
It's not beyond the bounds of possibility. And it hasn't happened yet, but it would be socially so awkward. I mean, again, how I suffer. I would have to have an uncomfortable moment with Stephen Fry in the Delaunay restaurant.
That's the most hate you get on our comments. And Tig, we will come back to you. The most hate you get on your comments.
I'm fine, guys. I'm having a great time.
Is that awkward photo of you on the train with Badil. And we still get comments about that as if you're now best friends.
Yeah.
After you've like railed against him so much and then you bump into him on a train. and you were polite. You didn't like cause a scene on a public train.
Yeah.
People fucking give you a hard time for that and act like you're besties. But not that many. It's like one or two people. But that's the only thing.
Well, yeah. It is. It is.
It's actually lefties who give us a hard time.
Yeah. That doesn't surprise me, actually. The left is still masterful at tearing itself apart. You can even see that in the pro-Palestine movement.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We do an amazing job of subverting ourselves, I think. To come back to you. So you live in Cork, is that correct?
Yeah, I live in Cork in Ireland, yeah.
What's that like?
But I'm spending more and more time in Middle Eastern countries. Like, I've been there a few times now, and one thing that's actually really interesting for me in the last year and a half, to just go back to comedy briefly, is that there's a whole world out there for comedy. So it's another kind of pseudo-imperialist thing that we have over here, I think, which is that, you know, when you hear comedians going on world tours, generally speaking, it's the US, Britain and Australia, maybe. Like, that's the kind of world tour. And as it turns out, there's all these people, like, in the global south that like to have a laugh as well, you know? So,
tell us about that. So how would that work?
So like I was in, I know again, most of the time the invitations are for the fact that I'm partly doing activism as well. So it's not necessarily doing comedy yet, but like I was just in Lebanon and I had like an amazing experience. I was over as part of a delegation for the funeral of Hassan Nasrallah. So it was mental, and I was like hanging out with Houthis. I did like a couple of comedy sketches with a couple of Houthis. Actually, I'll send them on to you. Brilliant. Like, this one particular Houthi is going to be like the next big thing in comedy. Like, I'm trying to launch a kind of at home with the Houthis, which I'm sure Netflix are going to be all over, like, you know. But the point I'm making is that there's a lot of people in Beirut, for reasons best known to themselves, are aware of all these kind of anti-imperialist comics. So I'm hoping to go back to Beirut. Maybe my partner's having a baby soon, so it won't be for a couple of months, but maybe in August, to do a gig in Beirut. And in a dream world, I do, like, if I go back touring, I tour that part of the world almost like first. Right. And I think that would be an interesting way for a comedian to express true anti-imperialism as well, rather than just like, I'm doing my little anti-imperialist shtick in a gig in London, you know? Like, it's not like I've done massive amount of touring, but I have done Britain and it's been brilliant. But like, yeah, I'm just trying to broaden my own mind, I suppose, and whatnot. Because like, these countries are hungry for material. It's just like, in the case of Lebanon, they just don't really believe that anybody in the West is A, interested enough about Lebanon, and B, would come over there because it's such a dangerous place to go. Yeah. And it's so dangerous because the West just destroys it like cyclically every kind of 15 years, you know what I mean? So,
I mean, you do it in English, presumably you would.
Or like I did one or two little bits of TV in Lebanon as mental.
Yeah.
And you'd have like an Arabic translator in your your ear, like, and when that cuts out, that's quite a moment when the Arabic translation isn't working and you're doing live television in Lebanon, like, and you're just this fucking comedian from Ireland that has wandered in to the studio, like, you know, interesting. But yeah, I love it though. I love it. There's definitely upsides, you know, which obviously sounds bizarre and crass to say, like, there's an upside during a genocide, but my own mind has been blown open from kind of anti-imperialism as an abstraction, as something that I'm reading about, to know something that I'm experiencing and making friends, I suppose, who have been victims of this kind of way of thinking in the West, which is that we might make mistakes, but we're vaguely the good guys, and all those brown countries are just perennially up to no good.
I was there was one of the things you could do is, I can't really talk about the details of it, but there was a time when I was in the Middle East and something really terrifying happened, really life-threatening. And suddenly me and Linda both became fluent in Arabic. The degree of terror that we were experiencing in this moment.
What the fuck happened?
And we just suddenly understood what everybody was saying, even though they were switching from English to Arabic. We suddenly felt that we were fluent in Arabic because we were so frightened. we understood what everybody was saying just in that moment. Yeah. We were so terrified. Yeah. So that's if you want to become fluent in Arabic, rather than taking lessons on the internet or whatever, scared. Just get terrified.
Yeah, we've got our, you know, we do tyranny pretty well over in the Middle East, but
you do. I mean, and
that's
you know,
only the implants. That's the fucking, you know, the implanted leadership that have been, you know, that is
well, exactly.
That is the result of, you know, these false borders being drawn across
Although Abdullah himself was Palestinian.
Yeah.
But he'd been subsumed.
But the people are beautiful, and the people are so nice. And like you know, I remember growing up, telling people about my trips to Syria, and they'd always be like surprised when I say, "Oh yeah, everyone's really nice." You know,
it's one of the things. Yeah,
you're looked after, you're fed. You know, there's nice bars. You know, people are like, "What bars?" Like,
yes. That's kind of demented hospitality of the Arabs, is it? Is and it sounds it sounds imperialist and kind of patronizing, but people are so nice to you. Really.
It's weird.
Demented is a good word for it. Yeah, totally.
It's not just we're happy to share. It's like you must have our stuff.
Yes.
or else I will perform harikiri. You know.
Yes. Let me give you my shoes.
You like my? You like my shoes? Take my shoes.
Yeah, take my hat.
It's crazy. But that's also, I think, that's just a non-Western thing because that's the same in Japan. You know,
guys, it's actually the same in Ireland. That's the thing. That's why I think the Irish have a unique perspective on this whole thing, because we've probably got more in common with, you know, colonized Arab nations than we do with Britain. You know what I mean? Like, so I agree. It's very Western because it's very consumerist and it's very individualist to have the kind of thinking that we have over here. That's why I think when we go over there, we're like, whoa, these people want to share a meal with us and invite us to their homes. That's kind of the norm.
Like, yeah,
we're abnormal, like.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Because Ireland is, as you say, so conservative, but then you do also have that experience of being a colonialized people that must be very profound, really.
Yeah, and I think our conservatism is more like it comes out of, you know, starting a new country, and it was like Catholic dominated, and it's socially conservative, but it doesn't mean that we're conservative in terms of we would still. I mean, obviously, it's not as much as it would have been. But if you go to rural Ireland, even right now today, we would make a big deal of you, like if you didn't know your way around and welcome you in. We still definitely have that spirit. And I definitely found when I was like in these countries, like as I was in Qatar as well, and I was in Iran, which again was a total eye opener because obviously, like I'm not, you know, a massive fan of the government or anything like that. Like, but the stereotypes that you get in the West, a bit like what you're saying there, Talal, is like that basically Iranians are like horrid, evil people as opposed to regime. They get thrown into the same milieu, I think, in the kind of vague Western sense of these places. So to go there and be like, these people are unbelievably friendly. They're so fun, you know, fun loving. They remind me a lot of the Irish mentality a little bit. I do think. The West has, and like the BBCs of the world and the CNNs of the world or whatever, they've done a masterful job of kind of dehumanizing an entire great swathe of the planet, I think.
Yeah. I mean, you can't murder somebody. You can't patronize them if you know their humanity. You can't murder somebody. You can't, you know, destroy them. If you have to other them, you know, it's a basic human instinct that. And that refusal to humanize Arabs or Iranians is about, really. I think. I mean, isn't Ireland though? I mean, at least the Israelis have withdrawn their ambassador from Ireland and stuff like. I mean, isn't that indicative of a certain level of resistance to Hasbara, you know, Israeli, you know, the Israel power in a higher level.
Definitely, but it's popular, you know, it's because there's so many people are so active, you know, on the streets that the government has had to pander a little bit to the kind of popular support for Palestinian liberation right. and justice. It hasn't come from a government level, like we're, because the Irish government, as I say, we've never had a left-leaning government. We've always had this kind of slightly centre-right Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, two dominant parties in the south of Ireland. They've always been in yeah. power, and they're for a long time now beholden to US multinationals. So it's not right. so much that we're cowering to Zionism, we're cowering to kind of the dollar, like, you know.
Right.
So like our leader went to the White House recently and just basically made a holy show of himself, like, and kind of sucking up to Donald Trump, who you kind of wondered, did he even know who he was? And then he invited, then Trump invited like Conor McGregor, like the next day to hang out with him. Like as a satirist, like it's over. Like game over. There's nothing left to satirize. I mean, like, you know,
yeah, yeah.
It's done. Yeah. But basically if those US multinationals, big pharma and big tech, if they leave Ireland, which they easily could, we're yeah. decimated, like our economy falls apart on the spot. So right. we are kind of propped up economically by the US. So, you know, you could argue that the government is in a tricky position if you're conservative yeah. and your whole life is, you know, the American interests or whatever. But yeah.
Actually, just going back to the Aldi question, what's happening? What's up with Dunn's Stores? Is that still going?
Yeah, yeah. Dunn's Stores guy, yeah. yeah?
Well, they've got a branch in Malaga, so I was sort of fascinated by and also so yeah, it's like, what the fuck is this? That's the first, my first Dunn's store I went to is in Malaga. Yeah.
I would say this podcast is just gonna be impossible for somebody to listen to. Because there's no there's no thread, there's no, I mean yeah.
No.
Well, you still haven't answered the fucking question. Why is genocide a bad idea?
Well, it was also, wasn't it, that the patriarch of Dunn's Stores was also. I read a book by, is it Fintan O'Toole about, called We That's Don't right. Know Who We Are, and there was a lot about Dunn's Stores in that, and the patriarch of the family, and then the subsequent.
And of course, still going, Dunn's yeah. Stores is.
what's a good bargain? What are they doing?
It's still a big thing. Yeah, Dunn's Stores is kind of like you'd want to be doing okay to go to Dunn's Stores. Like, you know, the riffraff are really? All shopping in Aldi and Lidl now. Like, I'm a yeah. big Aldi guy. I would go to Dunn's Stores on my birthday. You know, like that's a big treat. And then obviously Marks and Spencer's is just Anglo-Irish nonsense, like, you know, so you wouldn't be found dead there. But obviously Dunn's then has a great lineage as well, because, you know, like the Dunn's Stores strikers were a big part of the anti-apartheid movement in Ireland, to go back to an actual right. genuine point. Yeah, because like we had some, well, I didn't have them, but some brave young women refused to handle South African goods. And they were in Dunn's Stores, and they're really kind of feted in South Africa these days, yeah, because they kind of kickstarted a little drive towards anti-apartheid policies in Europe, yeah.
Right. Oh well, wow. You know, that's something that worked, isn't it? Again, that's an example of boycott.
Where I thought you were going when you brought up Dunn's Stores, but actually, you were just the obvious thing. No, just interested in Malaga, like. Yeah, yeah.
yeah.
Which is also fine, you know.
Yeah, yeah. No, just
so, Tyke, tell us about Tuesday, Tyke.
I'm talking to an anti-imperialist comedy hero of mine, like, you know, and I just thought he was going to go there, like, you know, with the whole Dunn's Stores thing. But anyway, so basically,
you've been through that arc. You see, you've been through that arc with me of, like, you're one of my proteges. If you've, you yeah. know, you started out this interview in awe, and now you're already disillusioned.
Yeah, yeah, you got a lot.
It's a rapid, it's a kind of a rapid version of what usually happens. Me and
exactly. Yeah, we just don't have the time to do the full circuit, like. so neither of us have that time, you know. So yeah, so Tuesday, I think I was saying to you there, Talal, that I have a bit of a following on Instagram, and I can feel the pressure of the kind of Zionist lobby. They've just taken on. Meta have now taken on more Zionist staff. So I feel like I'm on the verge of losing the page. That's very possible. I've lost my TikTok and I'm starting to get higher up the naughty list, I think. So they're going to try and take me out because they're just experts at kind of isolating people. And there's people with way bigger profiles than I'll ever have who have lost their pages and there's just no coming back. with that in mind, I was feeling frustrated because the whole genocide thing, which again, I'm like, just to put on record, totally against. I can't think of anything positive
good,
about it.
Good.
Clarify. And so I said, let's do something with that. So I just picked a date in the calendar, and there's a few activists who are with me who are doing brilliant work. And we said, you know, this is just a dream, I suppose, but even if it falls flat in its arse this time, maybe somebody else will take up the ball and it could snowball. If we pick a date in the calendar and we try and get everyone who's willing to do the bare minimum of not buying shit, like just don't buy any stuff at all, just don't give to the corporate machine at all, particularly not kind of Zionist associated goods. In an ideal world, don't go to work, and then organize your own acts of civil disobedience, whether they're kind of potentially occupying buildings, whatever. I won't go into too many details for obvious reasons, but whatever you choose to do. And if we did our thing in Ireland, and then if people did their thing in Berlin and London and whatnot, wouldn't that be great? So that's what we're trying to get off the ground. And I've had actually a very big response to it. I would say I'm definitely encouraged by, like, we've had hundreds of emails from people saying, oh, I'll take the lead in my town in Germany, or I'll take my take the lead in Sweden or whatever. And there's been a good push. There's a few celebs have come in it. Susan Sarandon shared it on Instagram, which was a beautiful moment for my pathetic little life. I love her.
Oh.
My girlfriend. And
No way.
No, there's a thing, there's a thread in Imaginary Sandwich Bar with Susan Sarandon's my girlfriend. And then and then she's stolen off me by Liam Dutton, the weatherman for Channel 4. Still, my girlfriend.
Oh, that's right.
I still think there's still a spark between me and Susan, anyway.
Oh, I'd love to see that. I'd love to see that.
Sorry, I keep bringing it back to me. I'm sorry. So tell us the date of this. It's a really interesting idea, and it's obviously non-violent, but I think something really profound.
Yes. What? So it's April 22nd. It's the Tuesday coming, but like that's just going to be the start. So the next, the next definite date, I'm sure, will be the 15th of May because it's NACPA Day. And we'll have plenty more. But the idea is that, like, if you, like, one of the hashtags we're using is, like, one step more. So if you've been doing this amount of activism, like, just to take the next step, maybe. If you've done nothing whatsoever, then the one step more might be just to do something. We're hoping to make people feel as comfortable as they, you know, that they can just do as much as they can or they want, and that's fine. And then other people might take a lead to do a little bit more. I suppose it's one last desperate attempt for me to use the clout that I have online to just try and get as many people activated as possible. Because definitely one other encouraging thing is, like, as I've done, like, you know, I've done gigs in England, I've done gigs in Ireland when, you know, they're Gaza fundraisers, or they're just like, you know, public meetings on this issue, and everybody is ready to do more. Everybody just wants to be emboldened to say, will it be okay? Like, am I going to get arrested? Am I going to get a criminal record? Or can we do this together? So if we can just get the collective going, the aim of the game is that nobody gets arrested. I don't want to say, like, oh, go and do this thing, and then some young fella goes out and gets a criminal record because of me. Like, the idea is that none of us get arrested. But for that to happen, there needs to be buy-in from the public. So we just need more people.
Hmm. Yeah, no, I think it's... just say again what it is. It's 22nd of April, and you are encouraging people to...
Yeah, so it's a global day of civil disobedience. Don't go to work if you can. Don't buy anything, and engage with your local groups. Pretty much everywhere that I have seen has got amazing local groups that are willing to take the lead on particular acts of civil disobedience. And if we're all acting out at the same time, there's no chance that we're going to be criminalized, because we will just be ungovernable. Like, it'll just be too much of a headache for police. So nobody has to break the law. Nobody has to kill anybody. Nobody has to smash anyone's face in. We can do so much with civil disobedience. As academics have proved, I think if there's 3.5% of the population buy in to a particular issue, then it's enough for the government to take action. And it's ambitious. Okay. I'm a dreamer, but we've got to dream at the moment, because otherwise we're all going to lose our minds and kick the shit out of each other.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
And I'll just say, I just looked at a very popular online shopping website, and you can buy a 12 pack of stink bombs for only £12, in case that's of any interest to our listeners.
That's of huge interest, you know, to our listeners, I'm sure.
Everyone's got a McDonald's nearby, or a Starbucks, or
This is him saying this, not me.
I'm not saying anything. I'm not saying what to do. I'm just saying those are facts I've just said.
The Arab is saying this.
Those are two separate facts I've just said that have nothing to do with each other. And not
they're certainly
anything.
Interesting when you put them together, though, aren't they? Yeah, very interesting.
That's amazing. We have a very popular local Palestine activist group. I'm definitely going to find out what they're planning on that day, and if
Thanks,
they're not, I'll float the idea. I think it's quite easy if you look online for PSC, you know, PSC, Palestine Solidarity Campaign, plus yes. your local area. You will have a contingency in your area, also with a Palestine boycott, plus the name of your area. Search for terms like this, and you will find your local groups quite easily, dear listeners.
Exactly. And what we're saying to people as well is that, you know, this is not a leftist issue. Like, this is not some sort of hobby horse for fucking commies. Like, if you're against the mass murder of women and children and executing
and
medical personnel and journalists and men, of course, then, you know, this is your cause. So
I agree. Well, this podcast wholeheartedly supports this message.
Try that again with a bit more enthusiasm, Alexei.
This podcast, I'm 72. This podcast has only got... This podcast wholeheartedly supports this message. Do nothing on April the 22nd. That's easy enough for me.
Love it.
And while you're listening to advice, listeners, please check out our Patreon, patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast. Tig, you have to listen to this. Please,
I love it.
patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast. Support the show, support the movement, be part of the community. We've got chat rooms there. We post full video episodes of our podcast. You get to see Tig's face while he giggles away at all the jokes and look at that, and you could see him, Alexei, roaring with laughter at the idea of a shot. and once we get to 500 paid members of the Patreon, we're going to do Strangers on a Podcast, where we're going to invite you listeners onto the podcast to talk to Alexei for a few minutes or moments or seconds, however long he can tolerate you before we get the next one on. Email us alexiselpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us online, alexiselpod, on the socials. I think that's all the plugs I have to make. Would you like to do any plugs, Tig? Anything you want to draw people's attention to? And if your Instagram gets taken down, where will people then find you? Are you going to start have you got a forum online or?
Yeah, I have a website. Yeah, so it's just myname.com if people are looking for me. But April 22nd. Thank you.
Yeah, no, it's really, that's great. Thank you, Tig Higgy. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Pleasure.
Give us a shout when you're in London. That'd be lovely to.
Absolutely.
To
I'd love to be one of your. Could I be?
A bit old, I think. I'm trying to stop doing that with it.
Let's go for a drink, though, for sure.
Yeah.
100%.
And next time you want to go Middle East, hit me up. Because I could be your translator.
Oh, my God.
That sounds like fun, man. I'd love to go out and do a gig out there in Beirut.
Love it, yeah. Yeah, well, I'm hoping to try and speak to somebody over in that part of the world to try and get a tour together. Like, that would be a fucking dream. Do Beirut.
Yeah.
Cairo, yeah. I've got a couple of there's a brilliant satirist in Cairo at the moment who I'm in touch with. I was going to say something else. Oh yeah, I think they're. Do you know Jen Brister? You know Jen Brister, comedian.
I've forgotten.
She's rings a bell. We're both very out of touch.
Stand up, yeah.
she's big in the pro-Palestine scene, but I think she's trying to put together a big comedy kind of gala in London or whatever, which I might come over for in a couple of months' time.
Be so great, yeah.
Will I try and get you guys on the bill?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh yeah, she hosted the map event that we did that you did in the Roundhouse, Alexei.
That's right.
Yes, she is great. And she is great.
I should say that Radio 4 amazingly the Radio 4 charity appeal is for map. I've just recorded it yesterday. Wow. I can't remember when it's gonna go out, but it's it's sort of brave. I mean, it shouldn't be, but it's kind of brave of the BBC to even go that far, really. And there was
of course it is.
There's It's about, you know, so I tell the story of a, you know, a woman in Gaza giving birth prematurely, and you know, through that there's then an appeal for funds from MAP. The situation is probably even bleaker than it was the situation that I described. But you know, it's a fair place to Radio 4 for.
I'm astonished.
You know, something like that, which should be,
yeah,
which should be just, you know, there should be no controversy about it, to do a Radio 4 to allow their charity appeal to be for MAP, I think is quite a big thing, really. And I was very honoured to be the voice of it, really. So
yeah,
I'll put that out to our readers and stuff, and listeners, as it were.
I'm encouraged by that. Yeah, I didn't think the BBC would go on air or something like that. Like, that's actually kind of comforting in a way.
Sometimes think of the BBC as being homogenous, but it's not really. It's an organisation, and obviously the forces of darkness are very strong within the BBC, but it's not a voice, it's not an organization that speaks with one voice. There are good people in there, and they try their best to do their best, really, and they face tremendous opposition, but there are, you know, it's the BBC is not a single entity, really, for at least for the time being,
just like Arabs. Yeah.
Yes, just like, always bringing it back to Arabs, aren't you? You start talking about hummus in a minute, and then we know.
I've got a song about hummus. Done. Do you want to hear it?
No.
Okay,
no.
We'll say goodbye then.
No.
Just like Arabs. Now I suddenly feel scared.
Yeah, you understood what we were saying.
Perfectly, I'm terrified.
Gotta say goodbye before I start breaking stuff, Alexi.
Bye bye. Masalama.
Free Palestine.
Masalama. Free Palestine.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tyke.
Yeah. You've been listening to the Alexi Sell podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexiselpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.